This is, just to clarify these things, the quest for the real Jesus, and my name is John. Good to be sure about these things. I inadvertently, on one occasion, got on a plane hoping that I was going to Tirana, Albania, and was headed to Africa instead. Of course, a lot better than that fellow that I heard in San Francisco. He was getting on a plane just to hop across the bay to Oakland, and when 3 hours later, I realized he was on a flight to Auckland, New Zealand. So we want to be in the right places. Well, the historical credibility of the scriptures with a focus on the Gospels here. One of the conspicuous features of recent historical Jesus scholarship, if you've encountered it, is the tropical profusion of portraits of Jesus that it presents us with. I mean, what a bewildering melange of idiosyncratic Jesuses that it affords. I mean, ranging from the academically esoteric to the fantastically bizarre in some circumstances. Jesus, the subversive cynic, or Jesus, the poet, peasant, provocateur, even Jesus, the Egyptian magician. I mean, all kinds of Jesuses. It's a veritable chaos of creativity that we see. But for all the diversity, there seems to be a commonality within these divergent profferings, especially the ones that are most vigorously popularized in the public. That is, they almost all offer us a Jesus utterly unrecognizable to the Christian faith. Utterly unrecognizable. A Jesus which bears scant resemblance to the portrait that the Gospels provide us. Little surprise that the reaction of some Christians recalls the words of the dismayed women at the tomb. They have taken away Jesus. What have they done with him? And after the initial shock, Christians find themselves asking, how do historians come up with this stuff? Where do they get such constructions of Jesus? I mean, certainly not from the Gospels. I've read the Gospels, and there's no similarity. And this is one of the questions for which I want to provide some explanation as to how this sort of thing happens. How is it that serious scholars arrive at such jarringly divergent representations of Jesus, and especially reconstructions so utterly remote from the gospel descriptions? And having elucidated, I hope, the common dynamic here, then I want to offer a corrective that will helpfully nudge us toward a reestablishment of some sanity in this area, kind of a lost sanity in the historical Jesus research. So first, and I will try to conscientiously follow the outline. First, how the historical Jesus scholarship has lost its way, or what I might be tempted to entitle the origin of the specious. So first, current practice. What do we see out there currently? How is it that scholars working off the same historical data manage to arrive at so radically different reconstructions, all claiming historical status for their project? Scientific history gives us this. And why especially do these representations of Jesus differ so markedly from the portraits provided by the Gospels themselves? Well, you might say that the process of historical reconstruction is always one that's partially conjectural. I mean, how one fills up the blanks. We don't have all the information in history, and you got to fill in the blanks somehow, don't you? Historians are always putting two and two together and coming up with 5 or 17 or 21. That's just kind of the way history goes. So there will always be differing perspectives. Now, that's true enough, but there's something further going on than just divergently filling in the missing bits. See, it's not so much what's going on with the blanks that concerns me, rather what is being done with the bits that we actually have that is so troubling. For the principal reason that we see such divergence in these portraits of Jesus is that most of these portraits that we have coming to us popularly, are largely unconstrained by the gospel material. That is, the material that the four gospels provide us. Why is this? Well, for reasons that I will go into in a moment, the historical accounts of Jesus that are given us in the gospels are adjudged to be unreliable, inauthentic, okay? And then much of the material is accordingly cast aside. And the little bit that's left over that is judged to be authentic really affords such scant scaffolding as that you really have the freedom to raise up any edifice that you'd like, tethered to that little scant scaffolding that's there. You can raise up a picture in a variety of different ways, very different from the original portraits that you have in the Gospels. Let me illustrate that with a diagram here. Say you first, say you've got something here like this, and that's what you start with. Okay, and then they come, different historians come, and they want to erase different bits that they think are inauthentic. So they do this sort of thing, and they think, no, that part's not really real, and they get out some of that bit, and we don't want that either. And so then they've got, this is pretty much what they have left. And then just with a few extra little strokes, you add a few other touches to your portrait, and then voila, you have something that originally is very different from what is originally there. I probably better erase this, or people are going to get the wrong impression. But you see how the game seems to work. If you adopt a methodology which provides a very heavy-handed axe to chop away most of the gospel material, why, then you're left with very few constraints for fashioning your own favored reconstruction. It's kind of like an architect. If an architect comes in and you say, you know what, you don't have to leave any of these walls here, except for just this one in the middle that's holding everything up, why then the architect can go wild as to what they might raise up on that. And kind of anything you want to dream up would work. And this is precisely what's happening. Historians concluding that history actually supplies so little reliable information about Jesus that we're left up to our own creative imagination to furnish the portrait, constrained by only just a few marks on the canvas. So let me ask, why in current practice do historians so readily and so radically dismiss the testimonies of the Gospels as they stand? Why do they regard them as so unreliable? Where does this rampant and regnant skepticism concerning the gospel witness come from? B, historical paternity. Now, I'm going to simplify here a little bit, but not too much. Skepticism regarding the gospel accounts stems largely from a dominant scholarly picture of how the gospels that we have came about. And paternity on this perspective goes back some 85 years to an influential German biblical scholar, surprise, surprise, somebody from Germany, named Rudolf Bultmann. Okay? He is one of his pivotal works, History of the Synoptic Tradition, 1921. We're going back a long way, but this is what gets the ball rolling. Okay? And he, Bultmann, noted that bits of the gospel accounts seemed like little separable stories which could be strung together in different ways in the various gospels. Okay? And Bultmann surmised that long before the gospel writers strung them together the way that they have them, they had had some long prior life being passed down from mouth to mouth, sayings, stories, parables, pronouncements, told and retold, and indeed in their retelling, reworked and reformulated. This is to say that before the Gospels came actually to be preserved in our present written form, their pieces, the little bits that comprise them, were passed along through oral transmission. Thus, the supposed authors of the Gospels were really just editors of an oral tradition that was passed down. And the functioning analogy was that of folk literature, okay, where stories are passed down along from generation to generation, and that's how you finally get the story. And indeed, the process of folkloric transmission was consulted by Bultmann and others that followed him as a means of yielding insight into how these Jesus stories must have been or might have been adapted and modified and creatively reconstructed as they were passed down. So this is the model that was at work. Have you ever played the party game, a rumor mill? You know how that works, where one whispers at the start a very detailed message into the ear of one person, and then they pass it on, whispering it to the next, and the next, and the next, and it kind of works its way all the way around the circle until at its terminus, it finally is blurted out, and it has often suffered substantial, and a lot of times humorous, adaptation. And this is the sort of story that's often told. Well, inevitably, this is the sort of thing that would happen as these stories, these little bits, got passed down. But if you study this process, if one could discover the principles and patterns by which these stories are typically embellished and adapted and augmented, you understand that process a little bit and you study that, well, one could develop criteria for getting back, working your way back to the original forms by kind of peeling off the successive layers of accretion that must have, kind of the moss that must have formed on these original little bits. Much like one might go about restoring a Giotto fresco or something, where you slowly peel off the layers of paint that had been super added, and you get back to what the original was. And again, the ruling assumption in this model was that it is the communities, the early Christians, the first church, that creatively engaged in shaping these stories, in shaping the tradition, and indeed especially sculpting these stories, just like good preaching always goes, sculpting these stories to address the existential concerns of the community. What do we need comfort about? What do we need to have addressed? Well, let's just kind of shape these Jesus stories to really address these needs that we deeply feel. So see how the community was considered to be deeply involved in shaping the way these stories came into being that we now have in the Gospels. Even creating stories and sayings and retrojecting them, putting them back into the lips of Jesus to serve their own current needs. So this was the story that was told about this. And accordingly, scholars have been convinced that the Gospels actually tell us, and this you come across this all the time, the Gospels actually tell us more about the Christian community and their concerns and their issues than they tell us about Jesus and what he actually did and taught. They tell us, as is often put, they really only tell us about the Christ of faith, not the Jesus of history. And those two things are typically contrasted. Okay, not much about the Jesus of history, but not nothing at all. Not nothing at all. We can still make out the faint little whisper of Jesus' voice, to use a phrase of Bultmann. We can still make out the faint whisper of Jesus' voice. And with a carefully devised methodology, it was fancied that we could get back beneath and behind the layers of mythic accretion and discover traces of the real Jesus. Restoring that fresco by carefully removing all the super added layers. And the sophisticated set of principles to do just that are typically dubbed the criteria of authenticity. And these are, I won't be able to go into those, but these are the tests that a gospel claim or saying would need to pass in order to be judged likely to be original to Jesus. Okay. things like double dissimilarity and multiple attestation. Okay, we can talk about these if you have more questions. These sayings have to pass these tests in order to be considered part of the data for the historical reconstruction. What do we leave on the canvas to then begin our reconstruction? Okay. And as we've mentioned, very little, for many, many historians, very little remains on the canvas. In fact, the Jesus seminar, that when they bring their winnowing fork to the material, they eliminate more than 4/5. There's under 20% that they judge to be authentic and left. Again, very few lines left on the canvas, so you can use your imagination to fill in the blanks, because there are a lot of blanks. They've left a lot of blanks. And as mentioned, this has been the prevailing orthodoxy, though it's pushed to different extremes by different scholars. But this is very prevalent in much of the contemporary historical Jesus scholarship. But there are good grounds for challenging the soundness of this narrative, of this storyline. So let me turn to some corrective criticism now and suggest a path to sanity. So you're on your outline, path back to sanity. The assumption on the Bultmannian model of oral tradition is that substantial alteration as it's passed down is inevitable in the transmission. Okay? That somehow the creativity of the Jesus community, the first Jesus community, is going to be the decisive shaping factor. Okay, that's the governing assumption. Yeah, you may be able to get back to the original kernel of something of what he said, but not until you dispense with all this encrusted husk. Okay? But, as it turns out, actual careful examination of the transmission of oral traditions has called this assumption into question. And decisive here has been the work of a Scandinavian scholar named Birger Gerhardsen. It's written as one of your resources at the bottom. Birger Gerhardsen. And Gerhardsen decided, hey, well, why don't I study the actual process of oral transmission in the historical context in which the Gospels would have been developed? So he went back to Rabbinic Judaism, which was really the heritage and the context of the gospel writers, and decided to study that to find out, well, what can we learn about how these sorts of traditions are passed along? Would there definitely be a lot of change and adaption that we could expect? And what he discovered was a very high expectation and a high capacity for oral tradition to be transmitted with phenomenal accuracy. In that culture, in rabbinic Judaism, of which the disciples would have shared, in that culture, the disciples were expected to memorize a rabbi's teaching. This was commonplace. Exemplary in this regard is Rabbi Paritas, and it was his practice that when he would have his disciple, he would repeat these things 400 times and then make sure that they got them. And if happened to be a dullard, his disciple was a dullard and still didn't get it, he would do it 400 times again, repeating these things. And there was a demand and an expectation that you would memorize your rabbi's material. And great importance was attached to preserving the exact wording. Gerhardsen also notes that if you take the Gospels, the sayings of Jesus, you translate them back into Aramaic, you begin to notice certain features about them that are also telling that Jesus was using this process. Because you begin to discover alliteration, assonance, rhythm, rhyme, wordplay. In fact, a recent German study, Rainer Riesner, says 80% of Jesus' teaching, if you translate it back into the Aramaic, is poetic. So, and again, this was the common practice. Rabbis would cast their words in a format that would be very easy to memorize because that was the expectation. And again, and we need to remember, too, that probably many of the things, most of the things that Jesus said, he would have repeated many, many times. Not just twice, but probably 200 times. I mean, he's an itinerant preacher. Now, some of the words, no. He probably didn't repeat the words that he uttered on the cross many times. Some were singular, but for the most part, repeated again and again and again. And this would have helped them with their memorization. N.T. Wright makes a lot of this. Again, attesting to this culture is the saying, the common adage from the Mishnah, a good disciple is like a well-plastered cistern that loses not one drop. See what the expectation was here? And the apostles in Jerusalem would have functioned to formalize and formulate the teaching of Jesus, which then would have been passed down with a large measure of fixity. Not the freedom to creatively contribute by the community, as postulated by Bultmann. This was not the way it went in that culture. And again, for these insights, see Gerhardsen's, he's got a work called Memory and Manuscript, or Tradition and Transmission, or I have one on the bottom, the resources there, recently reissued some of his works, 2001, The Reliability of the Gospel Tradition. Also, subversive of this supposition of accretion in the transmission has been the work of one Kenneth Bailey, who labored as a missionary in the Middle East, different very small villages in the rural Mideast, and he was there for over 30 years. And in these villages, the customs really had been unchanged since the time of Christ. So it's kind of a window into those original cultures. And Bailey's experience there similarly refutes the assumption that is so common that oral tradition must be highly unreliable. No, this is not the case. And he would go to the village, and they would have what they call their haflat samaz, where the elders of the village would get together, and this is where they would be passing on their stories and their poems and things like that that the community wanted to preserve. And he observed samar from shamar, to preserve in Hebrew. And he observed that where a community was motivated to ensure the traditions were preserved faithfully, they had very reliable controls to achieve that goal. So as someone would be rehearsing this, if they were in training, and when they uttered it, if ever they came up with a word that was a little off, boom, it would be corrected. It'd be controlled. It would be emphatically corrected by the listeners, drawing upon their collective memory. They'd heard it so many times, collective memory. And especially by those guardians of the tradition, the elders of the village. It would be corrected. We understand what this is about. If you ever really like certain Christmas carols and you're singing along one day and then suddenly there's been an edition that's been modernized, it's jarring. And you know, hey, no, the angels didn't say that. They said this. We know these things. And it's very easy for us to check and keep these things faithful. And again, depending upon the material and the desire for the level of transmission controls, they could be either more or less formal about preserving these things. Well, the upshot of these studies is, of course, devastating to the common assumption of the unreliability of oral tradition. It simply is not the case that traditions of the gospel stories could not have been faithfully passed on. It's just false. Both the ability and the desirability was present with the early church to get these sayings of Jesus accurately passed on. The teaching of Jesus was cherished, and the accounts of his sayings and doings were prized. They would have wanted to preserve them, and they were in a culture that could have preserved them. Well, the inevitable conclusion, yes?
So what happened in the villages? I didn't quite catch that.
In the villages, when they would have different poems or different stories that shaped the identities of the villages, they would come and they would rehearse these stories in the hearings of the young men there in the village to communicate them from generation to generation, because these are the stories that define our identities, that shape us, and we need to have them preserved and passed on. So they would rehearse them again and again on special nights until everyone was able to quote them and pass them on to their children and their children's children. So that's what was going on.
Where was the location of the one that did this?
He went around to several villages in rural Palestine. Okay. Yeah. And there's a reference in your when he wrote this up, and the resources at the bottom of the handout, the Familios article that he has that talks about this. But yeah, yes.
Well, one of the reasons why they've not written them directly after is just because writing materials that I read were hard to come by, because books weren't invented until the 2nd century, so they had to compose them on scrolls.
Yes, they did have they did have some means, but it wasn't commonplace. You'd need to be very motivated to do it, so you're not going to write your shopping list, you know. But something, if you were highly motivated to do, you could. And there's a lot of evidence that even our Gospels are based upon even earlier written documents. And scholars from wide range will talk about things like M, L, pre-Markan, pre-Lucan, Q, Quella, earlier written sources that were there. Interestingly, though, you know, we only have that literary evidence, but we don't have actual physical evidence for these things. And other scholars say, you know, they were so confident about oral tradition that there wasn't a tremendous motive to have to write things down. I mean, when was the last time I wrote down John 3:16 to make sure that I didn't forget it? I know it. I'm not going to forget it. we'll talk about that in a little bit. But our conclusion to this point, and it seems the inevitable conclusion, is that the whole project of Bultmann and his successors is erected upon a mistake. That oral tradition somehow means corruption of the original. That's just simply mistaken. And so much of this current scholarship, again, is erected upon that faulty assumption. But there is a yet more fatal flaw to the framework which has left its legacy with us still today. So this is B, the axe at the root. For not only would a process of oral transmission not, in fact, compromise the gospel accounts, as has been shown, but more decisively, the gospel accounts as we have them were not, in fact, the products of a long process of oral transmission. Such a long process simply did not exist. For the gospels claim to be eyewitness accounts, or else to embody eyewitness accounts. That is, that the authors of the Gospels are either themselves eyewitnesses or they are recording the eyewitness accounts of others, such as Luke, who talks about recording the accounts of eyewitnesses. So the Gospels were written down within the living memories of the events that they recount. Even on a relatively late dating, which is unlikely in my mind, they were still written down within the living memories of the events that they recount. All four were completed while there were yet living eyewitnesses. Though by the fourth gospel, the last gospel, they were getting scarce, and yet they were still alive. This is to say that the gospels were not the products of the rumor mill game, as we said, insofar as there was a rehearsing, that is, a passing down orally of the stories of Jesus. The parallel, if we wanted to give a picture parallel of this, would be to pass down the first person that kind of whispers. He doesn't whisper the story. He actually tells the story in the hearing of the first, and then the second rehearses it again audibly out loud in the heck with the first person that knew the thing listening and able to correct and present. And they might pass down a few, but by the time the first person who started it out before he dies, he's able to correct it all along the way. He writes it down before he departs the scene. So he, eyewitnesses, stand as a control during the whole process of transmission. You see how that's a very different picture that secures the reliability, where you have eyewitnesses that are present to act as controls during the passing along of these accounts to ensure that the testimony doesn't falter. And if it does, correct it. For the Bultmannian model to be applicable, you would have to imagine that right after the resurrection, the first eyewitnesses were immediately taken to heaven, you know, just completely disappeared off the scene, with the others who had just heard it one time having to desperately try to recall and fill in and make up stuff what they couldn't without any sort of capacity. They're all like kind of Robinson Crusoe that are on their own and can't check things up if their memory falters. But that's bizarre. That's not what happened. The eyewitnesses were there present as controls. See, it's a very different picture that we have. So, in imagining how the stories of Jesus reached the gospel writers, not oral tradition, but eyewitness testimony should be our model. Either their own eyewitness testimony as the writers of the gospel, or the eyewitness testimonies that they had access to and embedded in their accounts. And current Jesus scholarship needs to adjust itself to that reality and engage it responsibly. Well, what might that look like? Three, a more excellent way. Current Jesus scholarship needs to stop trying to get behind and beneath the gospel accounts as if the gospel accounts were trying to conceal Jesus. No, they are bearing testimony to Jesus, what they saw, heard, and touched. I mean, think about it. Can the attempt to reconstruct the historical Jesus other than going with the account of the gospel writers? The attempt to do all over again on your own what the evangelists, the gospel writers, actually did, can that effort hope to achieve any success as to what Jesus was really like? Somehow better or beyond what the eyewitnesses themselves tell us? I mean, the project is ludicrous. It's ludicrous. And many of the historical methods, these critical methods that they apply, are they sane? We didn't have a chance to go into them, but typically, to approach the gospel accounts with a principled skepticism, that is, to evaluate each individual claim on its own and admit it and give it credit only if that claim can be verified through some sort of independent grounding through something else, why, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. On this approach, you know, nothing that the individual eyewitness accounts tell us about Jesus is to be believable just because they witnessed it. Rather, only because historians have independently verified other grounds for crediting that single assertion. Well, again, this is to ignore the gospel for what it claims to be. Eyewitness testimony. No, sanity and indeed good historical methodology applied everywhere else in historical studies is to receive the claim to testimony for what it is and then seek to evaluate that claim as a whole. Generally. So one doesn't atomistically say, okay, they made this assertion. Were they true there? Now they made this. Were they true there? Were they true there? Were they true there? Were they true there? Kind of dividing it up and atomistically taking it. No. You try to get a general sense of, are they a good witness? Are they a reliable witness? Do we have general grounds for believing that they are an accurate, reliable witness? That's what you do. That's what you do in a court of law. That's what you do in history. Now, this doesn't mean that we are uncritical about testimony, but we ought to be disposed to receive its claim unless there are grounds for doubting it. In short, testimonies are innocent until proven guilty, or at least until they're under some sort of warrantable suspicion. Not the reverse. As Aristotle rightly asserts, the benefit of the doubt should go should go to the witness, not be arrogated to the critic. And if such were observed in historical studies today, the field would be transformed, and transformed, I dare say, for the better. So finally, what might be said of these witnesses of the canonical Gospels? Do they exhibit tokens of credibility. Say we were to do that and ask the general question, are they credible? Are these witnesses that we have credible? So finally, tokens of credibility. And again, the sober approach is to not require warrant for each individual statement atomistically, but rather to inquire whether there are good grounds for supposing the witness to be generally reliable. That's how you do it. Well, what can be adduced in favor of this verdict? First, let's ask, were the gospel writers in a position to get Jesus right? Were they in a position to get Jesus right? Well, as we've suggested, yes. We've emphasized that they were either themselves eyewitnesses or they incorporated eyewitness testimony. The author of the fourth gospel, the beloved disciple, however you might identify him, is an eyewitness. This is the disciple who testified to these things and wrote these things, and we know his testimony is true. So, in all likelihood, Matthew. Luke compiles testimonies, he says, of eyewitnesses from the beginning. Now, that from the beginning technical term, in the beginning of Acts, he says, in order to be an apostle, you would have had to have been with Jesus from the beginning, from the baptism all the way through to the resurrection. And those are the people that Luke is drawing upon, those who were there from the beginning. Okay? Mark preserves Peter's eyewitness testimony. If you look at Mark, Peter is the first person to appear as the witness and the last person to be there at the end, and his witness is incorporated throughout. Early church tradition speaks of Mark, Papias speaks of Mark as Peter's translator. Justin Martyr talks about Mark as simply the memoirs of Peter. You know, we're on good internal and external grounds there. Well, more could be said, but so these are their claims. Any corroborating evidence that we are indeed dealing with eyewitness testimony? This is their claim. Any corroborating evidence? Well, yes, there are many telltale signs that we are indeed dealing with eyewitness accounts. It has long been observed that the accounts that we have in the Gospels are sprinkled with extraneous details and local color that's really hard to account for other than by having been there as an observer. What sort of things do historians note and say, well, yeah, that's a telltale sign? Well, the feeding of the 5,000, and just as an aside, they sat down on the grass and the grass was green. How would you know that, or how would you say that, or why would you bother unless you happened to be there and you saw it and you just described it? Or Jesus is in the boat. He was a guest and he said he fell asleep on a cushion. Why mention the cushion? Nothing comes up. Well, it's just an observation. You were there. Jesus stooped down when he was addressing the woman who had been caught in adultery. Stooped down and he drew something with his finger. Nothing comes of it. It's not part of the, not developed. It's just an aside, an observation. So there are eyewitnesses. In Mark 4, again, talking about Jesus in a boat and in the storm, and the aside, and there were other boats. These are the sorts of things that historians are saying, yeah, telltale signs of being an eyewitness, of being an observer. Or the side you have in Mark, and it was night. These sorts of things. So, and these have been long recognized, more recently in scholarship, and these things keep being added and added to. More recently, very fascinating, a contribution has come from onomastic study, the study of names. Okay, from archaeology, we can list the most common names in Palestine in any given period. And they shift, just like names. You know, you look at books of babies' names, and, you know, they shift from season to season. Some things are popular. Well, we can know exactly what names were popular right at the time that Jesus would have been alive, and they're different from the ones after, okay? And interestingly, the names that you have for the Palestinian Jews in the Gospels and Acts coincide with the names of the populace at the time of Christ perfectly, and they don't correspond with the names that were popular later, okay, after the destruction of the temple, when some claim that these gospels were made up and put together. But that's like a time tag. If they would have actually written these things later and they would have come up with names for these people and made this stuff up, they would never have meshed perfectly with the actual names that you would have had during that period of time. This attests to these actual accounts being embedded, the cast being embedded in this particular time, right when they would have had eyewitnesses. past a time tag. It's a great test for authenticity of a contemporary context. Very fascinating. Similarly, these features, recent work has been done on the anonymity of, say, the people in Mark's Passion. So in this sense, many of the names are a giveaway that it was there. But then we discover that in certain situations, these Orthodox, they're afraid to give away the names. People are not giving away the names. Well, why is that? You know, you look at anonymity in Mark's Passion narrative. The man who cut off Malchus's ear, the servant of the chief priest, is not named in Mark, the earliest gospel. The man who fled away naked as his robe is taken. Or the woman who anointed Jesus. Why do they remain nameless? Why is this? Well, scholars say, almost certainly, the anonymity was protective. These stories and these accounts were circulating so early that if they would have actually given their names, that would have implied great danger to these people because their enemies were still in power who would have liked to have known who it was that cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. Who was it that would have anointed Jesus with a very political symbol? Don't communicate the names. Repress them in the earliest manuscript. Well, it's evidence that these were very early. Intriguingly, when the fourth gospel comes around, the Gospel of John, it fills in these names. And we turn out, aha, surprise, surprise, it was impetuous Peter that cut off the ear. Now we're safe to name him because things have changed after 70 AD. See? It also turns out that Mary, the sister of Martha, who anointed Jesus. Now it's safe to put in the name. So see how the anonymity, a protective anonymity, again, corroborates that these stories were circulated very early on, a time where it was still very dangerous for them to know. And these are just various things. Many strands of a rich weave of supporting evidence for the early eyewitness nature of the Gospels. Okay, the Gospel witnesses were well poised to testify accurately. So they were in a position to get Jesus right. Finally, is there any evidence that they did in fact faithfully report as opposed to distorting or inventing? Yes, let me extremely briefly mention just two tokens here. First, the presence and preservation of embarrassing material. That is, the sort of thing that the early church might like to suppress and certainly would not have invented unless it were really so. What sort of things do historians point to? Well, that Jesus' family, you remember in Mark 3:21, Jesus' family thinking that he was out of his mind. Are you crazy? Are you mad? Well, that's not the sort of thing that you want to promote, you know, if you're promoting Jesus. Okay, his family thought he was crazy. Or the baptism, that Jesus receives baptism. But everybody knows baptism is for repentance from sin. Well, how could Jesus, who's sinning, how do we explain that one? And yet it's there. It's part of the account. Jesus not knowing the time of his return. Oh, gee, but Jesus was God and he's omniscient. Embarrassing material, this sort of thing. Jesus' statement to the rich young ruler, why do you call me good? No one is good but God. Ooh, how do we deal with that one? Well, there are ways, but you see, this sort of material is very embarrassing for the church. They would never have made this stuff up. They might have tried to suppress it, were it not for their fidelity to the way things actually transpired. Again, supremely, that the first witnesses to the resurrection were women. Oh, my goodness. You know, women were disqualified from testimony that day. Josephus writes that they could not appear in court. In fact, it takes the testimonies of 100 women to match one man, they said. So if you're going to make this stuff up, are you going to have the first witnesses be women? I'm sure. No. But that's what they say. Why? Because that's the way it happened. And they were faithful to report the things as they were. Not to mention how the apostles appear as dullards, competitive, slow to grasp, doubters, deniers. I mean, you know, are you going to make up? And then Jesus said to me, if you're Peter, Jesus said to me, get ye behind me, Satan. And that's not what you want on your CV. And yet these things are here. The presence and preservation of embarrassing material suggests these are faithful witnesses to what actually took place. How could you account for these features otherwise, other than they're just truthful witnesses? And finally, similarly supportive, the absence of greatly desired material. Remember the assumption from the Bultmann in that project, say, the early church felt perfectly free to invent material and retroject it back into the mouth of Jesus to deal with issues that they had in the early church. And that's how we can account for all of these statements. Oh, but if that's the case, there were some areas where they would have longed for Jesus to make some sort of comment. Good grief. We've got to have Jesus say something about whether or not we need to circumcise these Gentiles before they come in. I mean, do the Gentiles need to become Jewish before they can become Christian? Well, that's our big issue here. Surely if they ever failed to resist the temptation to retroject something back into Jesus' mouth, they would never have been able to resist it there, but they did. Or the issue of speaking in tongues. Oh, gee, yeah, a lot of conflict. Nothing. So where it would be most conspicuous, where we predict most to occur, Jesus is completely silent on these issues, attesting the fact that, no, the church didn't feel free to invent statements and put them on Jesus' lips. No, they were incredibly self-controlled, and they didn't. And in fact, the evidence is that they were very careful to distinguish. You remember Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. I say, not Christ, but I, and in that sentence, two verses above. Now, Jesus says, the Lord, not I, but the Lord, carefully distinguishing. They wouldn't just blend those things. Well, I need to stop, but again, the tokens are many and varied that point to the truthfulness of the witness. The gospel, the testimonies of the gospel given to Christ have every mark of credibility and should be credited accordingly. And not dismissed and thrown out to embrace some other highly fantastic, however fashionable, alternative that is not based upon their evidence. Okay, well, let me, in whatever time that we have that remains, open up for any sort of questions, comments, cavils, critiques. Yes, go ahead.
When you made the statement later today, what kind of date were you talking about in the Gospels?
Well, the Gospels dating is kind of controversial, but I think that the way to start on this is to realize that Luke, okay, dating of the Gospels, the Gospel of Luke is the first part of a two-part series of which Acts is the second part. And if you look at Acts, it seems to me pretty obvious that Acts doesn't really end. It just stops, and it stops right before the trial of Paul, and he's kind of waiting to deal with that. So I think it seems pretty clear to me that it's going to be dated before the trial of Paul. So, at least before 64. and if that's the second part, you've got Luke earlier than that. Luke then is based upon other prior manuscripts, and Mark among them, so Mark's going to be earlier. It seems very, very clear that given the way that Mark records Jesus' predictions about the fall of Jerusalem, they're vague enough that if they would have been written after the fact, they would have been written a little bit differently, but it is before the fall of Jerusalem, and there's no mention. Aha, see, haha. Before 70, so I think we're pushing the Gospels from between 40 to 90. Yes?
Maybe you can help me with a question I've had.
Sure.
It's reported by some scholars, many scholars, that Mark is written first, and then they say that Matthew possibly copied from Mark.
Yes.
From Matthew. What always bothered me is the fact that Mark was written by this young fellow that Paul kind of had to correct a little bit, which is fine. And I also heard that he actually, it's a testimony of Jesus, of Peter.
Yes.
Well, why does Matthew, who was with Jesus as a disciple, seem to be dependent on somebody else to tell his story?
Okay. In one sense, there's a couple questions, but the synoptic problem, what is the literary relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke? And John's a little different, so you talk about that. Well, you know what? I don't think that there has actually been an intellectual problem that has absorbed more intellectual energy from more people than that issue. I'm serious. There have been millions and millions of hours of some of the most intelligent people to try to figure this out. And I don't think that we're confident about that. So I think that it's probably insoluble. But again, it would have been no problem in my mind for Matthew as an eyewitness to also credit the witness that is transcribed by Mark if indeed, as it seems extremely likely, Peter was behind that witness. And Peter, again, would have had access to things, Peter, James, and John, that Matthew would not have. It would have been clear to him that this indeed was the legitimation behind that, so we wouldn't have had any trouble picking and choosing and taking bits and borrowing on that as he forms them to his ends. So I don't see any problem with that at all.
So Matthew, he wasn't on the inside circle as much as Peter, so to speak, a disciple, so he wouldn't have as much information as Peter would have.
Peter would have had, I wouldn't say wouldn't have the same information, because again, these things would have been shared and known, and everything that Peter knew would have been shared, but there would have been things which would have been eyewitnessed by Peter that would not have been witnessed by Matthew. Okay, yes?
You haven't spoken to this, and maybe it's not really necessary or scholarly, but I'm always intrigued by the motivation of people like the Jesus Seminar. When you look at their work and you see the havoc it's created for some people that are not yet believers, I wonder, what is their motivation?
Yes.
And maybe it's not scholarly to talk about that.
Well, it's difficult to speculate about motivations, but you look, for example, in Funk, in the introduction to the five Gospels, will talk about this, and he will be very explicit about their motivations, and he says, this is not a precise quote, but in effect, the Jesus of the Christian church is not the Jesus of history. The Christ of faith is not the Jesus of history, and we need to rescue and wrest the real Jesus away from the church and help and bring them up to speed that the Jesus they worship is not the Jesus of history. So he is definitely, these are definitely scholars on a mission. And the whole thing is promoted by and financed by the Wistar Institute. And if you can go and you can get what they express as their objectives. And they are very much committed, this is kind of new for a lot of scholarship, in popularizing their findings. How can we go public with this? Because we don't want a Jesus who is worshipped. We don't think that that's the true Jesus. So yeah, that is their ambition. They really want they think that the Jesus that is worshipped is not the Jesus of history. And they want the Christians to realize that it is a, who we worship in our mind is a fantasy, historical fantasy. Yes. Yeah, you had a question?
Yeah. When you talk about the extreme reliability of the oral traditions of the rabbinic...
Yes.
What does that say about some of the rabbinic traditions that were not included in the Old Testament? Or you know, why do they make that distinction in some of the other rabbinic oral traditions that they have and they're not in the Old Testament? Does my question make sense?
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. Why they didn't consider it to be inspired...
Well, why? What is the implication that when you talk about the extreme reliability of the oral rabbinic tradition?
Yes.
What's the implication for some of the other rabbinic traditions that aren't included in the Old Testament? Like, does that mean then that those rabbinic traditions are reliable and we should have them in the Old Testament? Or?
Well, I'm talking about really this is the period from just prior, during the time of Christ and subsequent time that is actually studied, you have these rabbinic practices. Once a temple is destroyed in 70 AD, that's when they really take off because it's synagogue-focused rather than temple-focused. But a lot of these practices were practiced indeed prior to that during the time of Christ. But what I'm saying is they had the capacity from their culture to maintain, if they so desired, and they often did, a very precise accuracy, and that would have been the culture. What that means is that they were preserving the commentaries on different biblical books or the implications of Torah for people of a particular rabbi. Now, they wouldn't necessarily consider that inspired. I mean, they would be able to distinguish between Isaiah, which was given through a prophet, and then remarks upon the implications of Torah or law by a particular rabbi, because they just wanted to live faithfully under God's law. What are the implications of that? And rabbinics will deal with that. So they could still distinguish between the inspiration of the one and the fruitful practicality of the other. So, yeah. Yes.
I suppose some of us have had a problem with the oral tradition because we have looked at the oral tradition from the time of the writing of the Gospels on, as purported by some people, that it's a tradition from Peter down from Pope to Pope to Pope. And we've seen a tremendous corruption of the Christian faith in that tradition. At least some of us do.
Yes.
I mean, the inclusion of many pagan things like Easter, which is a fertility rite,
yep,
in the place of the resurrection. Things like that were corrupted, and it appeared it was by oral tradition that this came in, or maybe other things. So I've made this concern about that before, because later it seemed like it wasn't good. Or maybe I shouldn't say oral tradition. Tradition corrupted the Christian church, maybe to the place that we don't even see the real Jesus.
Yes. Well, that's right. I think oral tradition, where we're talking about a very precise means of transmitting what had been handed over. So Paul would say, what I have received, this I deliver over to you. Christ died according to the Scripture, this sort of thing. So that is oral tradition. That is, we're talking about a precise transmission of a body of information. And I think that you're using tradition more broadly of what ends up being the collective reflection of the people of God in some of these matters and how that's broader than doctrine. Yes, so I think that's an important distinction.
You made it very clear to me about this early time that we can rely on it. I'm afraid I took this later time and I colored the early.
I see. Yes, yes. Please.
The question is that if the oral tradition really kicked off after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, then what evidence is there that it took place before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem? What motivation did people have to use the oral tradition when they had the temple around?
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to make that claim that it doesn't... Oh, you're talking about rabbinics? Well, that's when rabbinics takes off particularly. But no, these processes had existed before. But I'm talking about Judaism. The Christian, their rehearsing of these stories began immediately from the resurrection. I mean, these testimonies, and if you think about it, much of the preaching of the first Christians embodied these sorts of things. So they were constantly rehearsing these matters. It's not as if they waited around until 70 AD to the destruction of the temple to begin rehearsing these things. This is part of the teaching. I'm getting the sign. I'm sorry, friends. We need to vacate immediately. But thank you for your patience.